So thank you for braving the hot weather, for coming tonight. I hope it'll be worthwhile. Not sure, we'll see. So in the last two talks, under the title of Life Sucks, we've been talking about the first noble truth. The truth of suffering or unsatisfactoriness of all existence under the influence or under the causal conditions of disturbing emotions, ignorance, anger, attachment, and so on, and the resultant actions or karma that we create regularly and repeatedly in this life and past lives through those disturbing emotions. So that second noble truth, the true origins or sources of suffering, indicates the reality of existence, that life is totally unsatisfactory because we have no control. We're unaware of the reality of the cause and effect actions of our past actions and present actions. We're unaware that in our confusion we cling to a misconceived self that doesn't exist in the way we think we exist, nor do the selves of others, all the people in our lives, friends, strangers, enemies, we misconceive them to exist in their own right, independently, and so on. And on top of that misconception, we project to those that please us, we project good qualities, or we elaborate good qualities that they possess in an enhanced way. And through those who we dislike, who threaten us or harm us, we project out of anger, we project negative qualities which don't exist upon them, but we believe them to. Or we elaborate negative qualities so they're much bigger than they are. And underneath it all, there's the fundamental misconception that self and others exist in their own right. So we don't understand that the very life that we experience comes from our own mind. We think that all the good things and bad things exist out there in their own right, but they're merely coming from our mind, and in our projection we distort reality. So from birth until death we live in confusion and unawareness of reality, and we continue to create more and more causes to be caught up in the wheel of life. We actually create our personal wheel of life. Now, we talk about the death and rebirth as being like a wheel, and the various realms of rebirth, very unpleasant, very pleasant realms, as if it's something out there, something separate from us. But actually, we all have our personal wheels of life. Similar experiences, similar types of rebirth, but it's all personal experience resulting from our personal actions. There is no supreme commander or architect of our lives, nobody out there, no Buddha, no God, no Brahma who's pulling the strings. Everything that occurs to us is dependent upon our own mind. And in that teaching, in that presentation, is the key or the source of change. We can really change. We try to change the external world. We have been trying since we were born, but it's very difficult to change the external world so that it conforms with what we want. It's impossible to change the minds of others, and so on. We know that. But we keep trying because we know no other solution. But the solution is possible because we can change our own mind, as I mentioned last week. We have the ability to generate wisdom, knowledge, which opposes the root ignorance. And through that wisdom, combined with recognizing the universal equality between ourselves and others, that we are literally one universal family. Literally. We've been each other's mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, husbands, wives, and so on. So many times, countless times in past lives. And when we look around, we can see in the news and the events, situations people get caught up in, we can really see how we are just the same. And it's only, it's not chance, because Buddhism doesn't talk about chance. But the people who are caught doing terrible things, thieving, killing, harming others so many ways, that they're just like us, but caught up in certain circumstances, unknowingly beyond their control, and so they just acted according to their distorted, instinctive self-centeredness and caused harm to others. Just as we've done in the past, maybe not as severe as murder and outright theft, we've done petty theft, but we could go along the same path. So much harm, and we know domestic violence is harm caused by people to each other, the very people who they probably invested their whole life in for happiness. It's not only husbands and wives abusing and killing each other, but children and parents and children and aunties and uncles. And, there's been so much in the news about the frequency of domestic violence and the depth of suffering, all coming from confusion. As many laws as we make, we can't force people to change. As many prisons as we build and lock people up, we can't force people to change. The only way we can change is to be individually inspired by a valid person who understands reality. Now, from my side, it took me a long while, maybe months, to investigate the Buddha's teachings and the teachers, Lama Thupten Yeshe, Lama Thupten Zopa Rinpoche, to see if what they were saying was valid. The implications of what they were saying were very clear to me, having worked in medicine and seen the reality of most medical problems are directly or indirectly related to mental problems. And being completely disenchanted with the therapy of tranquilizers and antidepressants, anti-anxieties and shock treatment, which I gave many times, believing that this is the way. But I knew that it wasn't the way. I didn't know the problem. So, having listened to the teachings, I became, and really thought about their meaning, and the individuals who gave the teachings, the two lamas, I realized that I had amazingly met two valid persons who taught a valid reality. So that's what we need. We need to meet a valid person, because books are good but not good enough. We all adjust our behaviour according to what we accept as reality, what we take in and really think about. And then we begin to modify our behaviour. In essence, establish a platform of pure morality, of non-harmfulness towards others. To do that, we need this inspiration of valid teachers. So, what I've been attempting to accomplish in these three talks is trying to present the picture as it was given to me, and you can think about it. You should think about it and go home. Actually, I've written out an outline for the talks, which comes to 9 pages, which I was going to ask Andy to print out for everybody, but this only evolved week by week and it wasn't finished. I've just finished it. So I'll send it to Andy, and you can put it on the website. And people can gain access. Because my verbal presentation misses important points. Anyway, if you like, you can have it for free. So last time we talked a little bit about karma, the introduction to the web. Karma is a broad term which covers the causal side and the resultant side. The causal side is the intention or the purpose behind our actions. So every moment of awareness, every moment of mind, has as part of it the function of intention. And intention is that mental quality or mental attitude that leads our mind towards something. You know, this intention, this purpose that leads us to engaging in some sensory experience or doing a physical or a verbal action. Intention and purpose. There's always some intention in our thoughts. Now, other mental qualities associated with intention can make that a positive or a negative intention. Intention itself is neither positive or negative. But if it's associated with a disturbing emotion such as anger, then the intention becomes non-virtuous, the disturbing attitude of anger. And so whatever action results from that non-virtuous intention creates a karmic potency upon our mind stream. And that karmic potential belongs to the category of phenomena. You know, we talked about all things which are changing belong to one of the three categories. They're either physical or they're mental, or they belong to the group which is changing but is neither physical nor mental. So karmic potentials belong to that group, and they are in general said to be born upon the stream of consciousness. So the non-virtuous intention of anger has established a potential. The result, somebody has been hurt by our angry physical or verbal action, and the inner result is this non-virtuous karmic potential placed upon the mind stream. And that abides. That will not weaken. It won't disappear. It remains on the mind stream even when we die, as it is the stream of consciousness that goes into the next life. Unripened potentials will go into the next life, whether they're virtuous or non-virtuous. When a potential gives rise to its result, then it can have multiple results or single results, but then it's finished. So our human life that we have now is a result of the virtuous potential that ripened when we were dying in our past life. But all the total experiences of this life, every pleasant, every unpleasant experience, is the result of the ripening of other potentials, both virtuous and non-virtuous. It's not only by giving rise to their effect that a karmic potential ceases. A karmic potential can cease by what we call the four opponent powers. These are mental qualities of having, first of all, recognizing that we made a mistake and admitting that we made a mistake out of ignorance. And so generating sincere regret for having hurt somebody through, you know, speech or physically. Within that sense of regret, there is compassion. We feel for them, we feel for the hurt that we have imposed upon them through our action, and we wish that they were free from that suffering. That's the second opponent power, which will begin to defuse and eliminate that karmic potential so that it doesn't ever ripen. The third power is to have to do a positive action. Like in this example, apologizing with a sincere mind to the person we've hurt. Or if that's not possible, then doing any virtuous action, there are certain mantras we can say, or any of helping others with the thought that this action will oppose that particular negative action. So we've got to have recognition of the negative action. And finally, we can complete the purification of negative potentials by generating the strong purpose or intention to not repeat the action, to not do it again. So those powers can stop karma before it ripens. And you see, they're all from outside. Buddha can't stop our karma. If Buddha could, who has universal compassion, Buddha would stop the ripening of negative karma. Buddha, this is, as I said last time, this is something that Buddha can't do. That is something that we can do, because it's our mind, and we are the only ones who have access to our mind. And that the door to that access to our mind is knowledge, learning through receiving teachings, through reflecting upon the meaning of the teachings, and through meditating, gaining single-pointed awareness of the reality imparted through the teachings. That is the door to liberation from our personal wheel of life. So it's possible. There's no reason why we cannot open that door. And we must. Okay. Now, the karmic potential that was like a latency or a potency born upon the mind stream, when there, it meets, when the person labeled upon that body and mind meets certain conditions, that karmic potential will ripen. A fundamental how does it ripen? It ripens as the mental activity or function of intention or purpose. So remember, it started as a purpose, as an intention. That's what set the karmic potential on our mind. So how does it give rise to its effect? There's this inner ripening of a karmic potential which moves our mind to experience a particular object, pleasant or unpleasant. And so it will be a pleasant object if it's a virtuous potential, an unpleasant object, an unpleasant experience if it's a non-virtuous potential. To check out whether this is correct, we should be practice mindfulness of what's going on in our mind. And just learn that this is how we can learn. You know, if we're walking along the street and we tread on a stone, or, you know, something unpleasant happens, check out what was I thinking? What was going on in my mind immediately prior to that experience? Was my mind in a virtuous attitude, like calm, peaceful, kind, friendly? Or was it agitated in a disturbing emotion of self-centeredness, self-concern, self-pity, or dislike towards others, or desire, attachment towards others or objects? What was going on? And then we can see for ourselves whether it's true that only bad things can occur when the mind is in a negative state, and only good things can occur when the mind is in a positive state. Now, it's difficult because the mind's changing moment by moment. We're fluctuating from positive to negative mental attitudes. But we've got to investigate my attitude. Why am I doing this? And start to modify. Start again, experimentally. We know we're going to see a person who we don't like, we don't really want to see. Okay. Instead of following that negative, avoiding thought, consciously generate a positive attitude in your mind towards that person. Now, everybody has some good qualities. Focus on them. Anger and dislike focus on the negative qualities, which everybody has also. Put that aside and generally think of their positive qualities. Think of their suffering. If they might be angry towards us, think of how horrible anger is and have some compassion towards them, genuine compassion. Then, this is all our experiment, then go to the meeting and see how it goes. See if their response to you changes, if your response to them changes. Now, this is the everyday homework which will verify or not the teachings on karma. So karma is not some obscure thing out in the sky. It is our own inner behavior, our own attitudes. And so we just check up. As I've said many times, after my first one-month course with Lama Tsofa Rinpoche in Kofan Monastery back in 1974, where Lama Zopa Rinpoche went on and on about selfishness and attachment and anger and so on. And I was tossing up about this Buddhism and thinking deeply and travelling overland from India to Europe. And when I got to Istanbul, I went to the American Express office to pick up my mail, because that was the only way you could communicate in those days. Telephones were too expensive, but mail was the way. So there were letters for me, and having had any contact with the family for quite a few months, 6 months or so, I eagerly stretched out my hand to receive the letters, and the lady behind the counter said, "Oh, you have to pay for them." And when you're on the road and travelling, you're doing it cheap. Even a small fee to pick up your own mail is outrageous. And so my mind became angry towards the lady. I don't think I said anything, but there was anger. I paid the money. And going out of the American Express office was these revolving glass doors. And so I entered the revolving door, and the glass panel in front of me, I saw the reflection of my face, and it was angry. And so I went in angry and I came out laughing. This is what Lama Zopa was talking about. This is anger. And how my mind was so upset. And it was really funny to see the reality of what he'd been saying. So I sat on the lawn outside and read my mail happily. In fact, I think that's a really good cure for anger, is when you are angry, go into the bathroom and look in the mirror and look at your ugly face. This is anger. That's why little children just have to see an angry person and they cry. It's just their face. It's scary. Okay. So, cause and effect of karma. Now, I said I was going to talk about the 12 links, which I will. This is Buddha's presentation of, you know, how throwing karmas, or rebirth karmas, the karmas which have the strength to cause a rebirth during the ripening of death. Now, it can be more complex. Our life can be a result of many karmas, you know, created to be human. Be many karmas we've created collectively can be the cause of a human rebirth. Or a single karma can be cause of a human rebirth. It's quite complicated. So we'll just think in terms of single karma. And the rebirth result. Last time I mentioned the other results of karma, that are not just rebirth results, but are the experiences that occur during every rebirth is a result of karmas. Good and bad, virtuous and non-virtuous. Just before I go into it, I mentioned that the ripening of a karma is associated with a generation of an impulse, an intention, a purpose, which will connect our mind with a particular object, pleasant or bad. But also we can create new intentions. If we learn something good or something bad through what we have learned, we can decide to embark on a particular course of action. So that intention, it's not the pure result of karma. That's a new intention which creates a new karmic imprint karmic potential upon our mind stream. So again, this shows us the opportunity that we have. We can have karmic impulses to do something, but knowledge can override that negative impulse and not follow it up, but to change our behaviour into a positive direction. This is practicing Dharma. This is the meaning. Initially, the virtuous minds are pretty weak, not so strong, but they can be virtuous. And gradually, as our capacity and our knowledge improve, and as we purify our mind from obstacles, our virtue becomes more and more spontaneous, effortless. At the moment, non-virtue is more spontaneous because we're confused about reality and we've learnt lots of wrong things in our life. Okay. So, in terms of rebirth, if we just talk about simply, the Buddha explained the ripening of a karma in 12 steps or 12 links. And they're like links of a chain, because the first link is connected to the second link, and the third link is connected to the second, and then that's connected the third also to the fourth. So it means that the second link arises in dependence upon the first, the third in dependence upon the second, the fourth in dependence upon the third, and so on. This is the meaning of the links of psychic existence. So the fundamental link, which we were born with, is ignorance, confusion. As we've already talked about, we have the fundamental confusion, not knowing reality. And in not knowing reality, due to past confusion in past lives, whatever appears to our mind, whether it's our senses or our thoughts, appears to exist inherently or in its own right, independent of anything else. Now, that is a mistaken appearance. That is a false appearance. But ignorance, not knowing reality, grasps at that appearance as true. So that is the first thing. And in terms of our own self, there's the self-grasping ignorance. Whenever we think I, our own I, which exists, appears to our mind in a wrong way. But we don't know it's wrong, so we grasp it as true. That is the root ignorance. We call it the self-grasping ignorance. As a result of that, we generate the disturbing emotions of attachment to things which please us, aversion, anger toward things which displease us. And through the anger and attachment, we create non-virtuous actions which will bring about an unhappy rebirth. Through ignorance, we can create virtuous actions. So how does this happen? Every action that we do has an initial causal intention, right? Intention, the operative word when we're talking about karma. There is a causal intention, which is the thought to do something. Then we actually engage in that action. So, whether a karma is virtuous or non-virtuous, the causal, the initial motivation always has the self-grasping ignorance. But then the action, the motivation or the intention during the moment the action is performed, a verbal or a physical action is performed, the intention can be associated, we can have a manifest virtuous mental factor, kindness, compassion, patience, generosity, or a non-virtuous mental attitude, anger, attachment, pride, jealousy, and so on. So you see, the root ignorance can precede two types of action, a virtuous action, which is, so this is the second link, the karmic formation or the karmic action. Okay, so that second link is based upon that ignorance from the causal side, and then the actual time, the motivation at the actual time of the action, that can be positive or negative. So we can have, we can create karmas for happy rebirth or unhappy rebirth. As I've explained, this karmic action, the second link, is intention. It is the mental factor of intention associated with either a virtuous or a non-virtuous mental factor. So that, it depends upon that action. The third link is established, and we call this link consciousness. But what it refers to, it doesn't create consciousness, doesn't create the mind, but it refers to the mind which bears the karmic imprint. Because during that second link of doing the action, the intention established the karmic potency on the mind stream. So that was the second link creating the third link. So the third link, called consciousness, refers to the karmic potential established on the consciousness. All right? So that can be looked at from the causal and resultant consciousness. So the causal consciousness link, right, this third link, that lasts from the moment it was established, moment the karmic potential was established, until the first moment of the rebirth that resulted from the ripening of that karma. And that's called the resultant consciousness link. You with me? So that can be many lifetimes, right? The causal consciousness link can be hundreds, millions of lifetimes. It won't change. Eventually, conditions will be such that will give rise to its result, the first moment of the new life coming from that karma. So you see, our mind bears innumerable numbers of consciousness links. The third link. From our countless past actions, which have yet to bring about a result, all of those potencies are born upon our mind stream. It's not just one, but countless. Okay. Now, I described the death process briefly last time. As we're dying, we go, our body and mind weaken, and it's when our capacity to distinguish between virtue and non-virtue, and distinguish between different things, weakens and is lost. During that time of weakening capacity to have some control through distinguishing in our life, in our mind, at that time the karma for the next life will germinate. So if the mind, this extra condition I mentioned before, if the mind is virtuous during that period of death, you're still breathing but you're sinking into death and you're losing your capacity to distinguish. If we can hold our mind in virtue, necessarily we will, that mind will nurture a positive karmic potential for a happy rebirth. If the mind is not in virtue, but is in non-virtue, is anger, whatever, it will. That is the soil which will ripen the seed of a non-virtuous potency and an unhappy rebirth. Right. So, the way the 12 leagues are presented isn't in actual sequence of how they happen, but we'll go through the presentation of how they're presented. So the fourth link is body and mind. The body and mind of the new life, which resulted from the ripening of that karma. Right? So ignorance, karmic formation, consciousness link, and then the fourth link is the rebirth. The body and mind, whether it's a human body and mind from virtuous karma or an animal's body and mind from non-virtuous karma, that is the fourth link. So that is the first, that occurs at conception. Whereas I mentioned the three factors required for conception, well, there are other conditions as well, but the three main factors are the sperm, ovum, and stream of consciousness. So the embryo is established, even a single cell embryo is established in the future mother's womb, if it can be human. So body and so this link, this fourth link, occurs from that first moment of conception through embryonic development into the fetus. And so we're talking something like 20 weeks. That varies a little bit. I can't remember my embryology. But when the fetus has formed such that the eyes, ears, nose, taste and touch, the five senses and the sixth sense of consciousness are all capable of functioning. Right? The sense organs are there, the mind is awake and conscious and able to experience the external objects after birth. So that is the end of the fourth link, the body and mind. Right? Body and mind. Body coming from sperm and egg, mind from the previous life. So we call this fifth link the six sources. So that means a source or the gateway for the five types of sense consciousness and the sixth consciousness, the mental consciousness. So when the fetus is at that level and it's able to, its body has developed to the point where its senses can function, then that link lasts up until it's born. It emerges from the womb, and then that was the fifth link. The sixth link is contact. When the baby is born, there's contact with the sensory objects. So that contact is either pleasant or unpleasant, according now to secondary karmas, which are ripening for the experience of pleasant or unpleasant experiences, according to whether the mind's virtuous or non-virtuous. And as a result of contact, there's the seventh link, which is feeling. You know, our senses are contacting objects all the time. And there's feeling, and feeling specifically refers to pleasant experience or unpleasant experience or neutral experience. So we can't help it. The seventh, the fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh links, you see how they're connected. We always have feelings. Then we can't help being attached to pleasant feelings and having aversion to unpleasant feelings. This is natural. But what's going on in the baby's mind or the young child's mind is there's still ignorance, there's still confusion, And so there's attachment, clinging. I want good things. I don't want bad things. And so there's craving for pleasure and craving to be free from pain. That's the eighth link. They follow one another. You can't stop it. Because of the subject who is experiencing pleasure or displeasure, the subject, me, is confused and projects all sorts of falsities upon self and upon the objects of pleasure and pain. So, we live a whole life doing what? Creating more negative potentials, more second links, more karmic formations through craving and aversion. Whole life. Very rarely do we actually have a pure, virtuous mind. Even if we're Buddhist, or, you know, a follower of a spiritual path, which does present morality as the foundation. And most, as far as I'm aware, religious philosophies do present a foundation for morality. But, really, if it's God's commandment, you do this or else, it's a bit heavy. The threat of external punishment is sufficient to avoid negative behaviour and create positive behaviour, but it's superficial. It's a bit like a parent telling a child to do this and don't do that. Why? Because you have to. Right? Because I say so. All right. But we know that kids don't always do what mummy and daddy say so. But to a degree they do, for fear of punishment. Better to have wisdom, not doing and doing through wisdom. And then you take responsibility. Wisdom is personal responsibility for your life. Your morality is your personal chosen code of ethics. That is so much stronger. It comes from wisdom and compassion. Okay, so we're on the eighth link. We're creating negative karma. Now we're facing our next death. That life is ending. And as we begin to fade away, we're grasping at existence. We don't want it. Oh, we're grasping at me, at life, at my friends, my family, my possessions. We don't want to go. We're clinging to existence. So this is the ninth link. And you can't help doing it, because that's the way we've lived for this life. That strong clinging, and we're sinking into death. So we're clinging to existence and going through the death experience. Again, our body and mind are absorbing, and our capacity to discriminate between virtue and non-virtue is weakening. So that craving and grasping at existence is the soil which nurtures the next imprint for the next life, the next karmic potency for the next life. And this tenth link is called existence. So it's given the name of its result. This is what will bring about existence, this link. What is this link? Remember, I said that a karmic potency is established by mental intention in the causal side. In the resultant side, that karmic potency gives rise to a mental intention. That fully ripened karmic potential, giving expression to an intention, a mental intention, that is the tenth link. The karmic potential is not intention. Remember, that belongs to the category of things which are neither mind nor body. But it's born there. When it's nurtured, it gives rise to an intention. And so we're sinking into death. Karma ripens this intention. And if the mind were virtuous, a positive karma would be nurtured. If the mind were non-virtuous, a negative karma. So the 10th link gives rise to the 11th link, rebirth. Wherever, in the 6 realms of rebirth. And every rebirth necessarily is the cause of the 12th link, aging and death. We begin to age from the minute we're conceived. Every baby. Birth is the cause of death. As we talked about in the first week, the eight types of human suffering. We rejoice at the newborn baby, but inevitably we have set up the process for the misery of this new person to die. So the 11th thing, birth, is caused the 12th thing, death, and we die ignorant. So back to number first link, ignorance. So that just is like a little picture of the 12 links.
Okay, so.
Yeah.
With the fifth link.
Huh?
With the fifth link, the sources. Surely the before birth, surely the fetus, the fetus, is able to hear and see.
Sure, there is contact, but it's just the definition of the sixth link of contact is contact with external objects.
But even the mother's body isn't.
Yeah, they're sort of more internal.
Okay.
The fetus is undergoing karmic ripening and mental experiences, but just for simplicity's sake, would. Buddha presented the 12 links to give it an overall idea. So Buddha defined the fifth link, the 6 sources, as being that period in the womb from the time the senses are developed up until birth. It's just definition. And definition of the next link is from the moment of birth when there's contact with external objects. But yeah, things also happening in the womb. Oh, you could die in the womb. You know, there's lots of things can happen in the womb. All right, so that is a broad picture of the 12 links. And so we come back at this stage now to the initial point of these talks, is to think about conventional reality and ultimate reality. So, conventional reality, I'll read the notes here. Conventional reality refers to all things existing in dependence upon other things, other factors. Right? The conventional person, or the self, exists in dependence upon our name and the basis of that name, the body and mind. As we've talked about, right? So I talked about John Smith last time. So the person, John Smith, came into existence when the parents decided to call their new baby, Mr. and Mrs. Smith decided to call their new baby John. With that decision, that labelling, the person John Smith came into existence. But neither the name John nor the body and mind which were suitable to be called John, or not even the combination of body and mind, are the person, John. Okay, that is conventional reality in general and in regards to ourselves. But through our inborn confusion about reality, things, when we think I, our own I, our own self, appears to be a real, true, concrete me here. Either the possessor of the body and mind or part of the body and mind, but there is some entity which is truly me, the real me, here. It appears that way to our mind, and naturally we take that appearance to be true. And same, mummy, you know, probably the first most important person in our life, mummy appears to exist in her own right. Some more than just the touch of her body, the smell of her body, the sound of her voice. There's a real mummy behind that soft touch, the sweet voice, the person appears. And we have no hesitation in taking that appearance to be true. But it's not true. Mummy is merely labelled upon her body and mind, and nothing about that body and mind is mummy in her own right. Of course, that's my mummy, my daddy, my toy. And then objects of aversion, brothers and sisters. So there's rivalry for mummy and daddy's affection, because we crave love, we crave affection. And any competitor is our enemy. So the self-centered sense of I, the most important person in the world, I need love, I need affection, I need praise, I need toys, presents, and craving, grasping at those things, and aversion to not having them, etc. Okay. So, we imagine ourselves to be more than simply labelled upon the body and mind. We imagine ourselves to be an independent person who exists in his or her own right as a possessor of the body and mind, or as some part of the body and mind. But if we try to locate such a truly real, existing real me, through deep analysis, really checking up, first we have to recognize the appearance of me as a real true me, and then investigate, check up. Do I exist in the way I think I exist? And really try to locate the I. Then we will discover that it can't be found. But that doesn't mean there is no I. It leads to the understanding of the ultimate reality of ourself, of our person. The ultimate reality is that of ourself is that it is empty of existing in its own right. Right? Empty means I don't exist the way I think I exist. So in Buddhism, you hear the terms selflessness and egolessness and so on. But these do not mean that there is no self at all. The self, or the person who eats, sleeps, lives and dies, is the person conventionally labelled onto the present body and mind. So that's the relative reality. Everything exists conventionally. Ultimate reality is that nothing exists in its own right. That conventional things like me are empty of existing in our own right the way we think we exist. So that the conventional person, John Smith, came into existence when the parents gave the name, and ceased to exist when John Smith died. But there still is a continuity of consciousness. The mind stream goes from life to life. It survives death. And so we can talk about the self who goes from life to life. And this is what happens, as I said, during the death process, all of the minds become more and more subtle to the clear light mind, the most subtle mind, which exists now, but is totally overwhelmed by gross thoughts and ideas. So that is the final basis of imputation of the self, the merely labelled, the most subtle wind and mind, the clear light wind and the clear light mind, is the final basis of imputation of the self. And that is what goes, separates from this body of death, and then becomes more gross in the bardo, the intermediate state, and then the rebirth state. So there is a continuity. There is a connection between future life and past life's actions. It's not the same person, John Smith, but it is the same continuum of consciousness. Now, same doesn't mean it's constant and inherently existing. It's changing moment by moment. But it's the same continuum. Same as the Murray River is the same in Albury Wodonga as it is in every part along the course of the river till it enters the ocean. We still call it the Murray River. It's the same stream of water, but it's the same name, but it's different, isn't it? So an illustration. I read this back in the 70s. In her local supermarket, back in the 70s, a little old lady once saw an actor who played a nasty character in a TV soapy. In her confusion and anger, she beat the poor man with her umbrella for doing bad things on the screen. Right. So she saw the actor as the character in the soap opera. So that was her confusion, seeing the actor as truly being the nasty character. And then, from that ignorance, that confused recognition, wrong recognition of the person, her anger manifested. So her anger came from both the confusion and the seeds of anger in her mind. She already had the seeds of anger. Anything she did not like, she automatically had aversion towards. So that's the eighth link. And so she beat him. So in reality, we can understand this, the actor was empty of being the nasty character. Yep. The actor was completely empty of being what she thought he was. But he still existed. Right? Oh, well, look, that's another story. Everything is outcome. But yeah, this is the illustration. So, her action of beating the man created a non-virtuous karmic potency on her mind strength. So you have ignorance, first link, you have karmic formation, second link. You have the consciousness, the third link, the karmic potency established on her mind. She couldn't help it. She had programmed herself, not consciously, but unconsciously, to be like that. So in a similar way, we see our own selves and the selves of others as persons who truly exist in our own right, even though we and others are empty of existing in that way. So everybody, including our own self, in our life, we're like a little old lady. We are projecting, exaggerating things which do not exist upon them, but we're acting according to our projections. We don't realize that the way they appear to us is dependent upon our mind. It's not coming from them. We've superimposed qualities which we believe are coming from their side. And so we get attached, we become disillusioned. Good word, disillusioned. Very good word. And we become attached again, and angry, and proud, and jealous, and so on. So we see others as inherently good or inherently bad from their own side, and we act. We create act through attachment and anger, and just like the little old lady with the umbrella, we create non-virtuous karmic potentials on our mind streams. Or if we've adopted, if we've learned a code of morality, we can create virtuous karmic potentials on our mind stream. So we have to realize that the reality of life is that we're all actors, and we create our own characters, and we play our own scripts. But nothing is as real as we imagine it to be. Initially, we imagine a true real self as a foundation of our ego, and relying upon improper or inadequate role models, we elaborate our mistaken self-image and the images of others in positive or negative ways, and we act then in life according to our self-centered and false projections, creating further karma. So the supreme path to Buddhahood is to consciously write our own scripts by using Buddhas and the representatives, the valid teachers, as perfect role models. Seeing them as role models for how to live our life, and gradually training our mind in wisdom and compassion. In the highest level of the path, in Tantra, we do this through consciously imagining ourselves as the Buddha in one of the meditative aspects, and developing a sense of pride, not the delusion of pride, but called divine pride, that, like, for example, I am Avalokiteshvara, the Buddha of compassion. So we can learn a practice to see oneself as Avalokiteshvara and have pride in being Avalokiteshvara, so that this will determine our actions, this wisdom and compassion of Avalokiteshvara. Everything I do is in harmony. We have to make it actually in harmony, and we can't trick ourselves. We can try, and we can rationalize and say that I'm doing this for compassion and for the benefit of sentient beings, which it's actually selfish. So these mistakes will happen in our practice of Dharma. We will not be practicing, we will think we're practicing Dharma, but we're acting selfishly. So, of course, natural, we've been acting selfishly since beginningless time. We're not going to transform overnight. So this is the method, to see ourselves as actors, to initially just imagine, not so successfully, that we've achieved the result, that our mind is wisdom and compassion. And this is so helpful. So we write our script in the morning, we write our script for the day of how to act through wisdom and compassion and not through attachment and aversion. We'll blow it throughout the day. And selfishness and anger and attack will manifest, but we'll recognize it. And so we apply the opponent powers in the evening, and we start again the next day. So this is the way to live. So in conclusion, I quote William Shakespeare in As You Like It. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances. And one man in his time plays many parts, his acts being seven ages. At first, the infant, mewling and puking in the nurse's arms, then the whining schoolboy with his satchel and shining morning face, creeping like snail unwillingly to school, and then the lover, sighing like furnace, with a woeful ballad made to his mistress's eyebrows, then a soldier, full of strange oaths and bearded like the bard, jealous in honour, sudden and quick in quarrel, seeking the bubble reputation, even in the cannon's mouth. And then the justice, in fair round belly with good capon lined, with eyes severe and beard of formal cut, full of wise saws and modern instances, and so he plays his part. The sixth age shifts into the lean and slippered pantaloon, with spectacles on nose and pouch on side. His youthful hose, well saved, a world too wide for his shrug shank, and his big manly voice turning again toward childish treble, pipes and whistles in the sound. Last scene of all, that ends this strange eventful history, is second childishness and mere oblivion, sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything. So we could have summed up William Shakespeare by saying life sucks. Any discussion?
He had great insight.
He did. As you know, as the teachings say, bodhisattvas can appear in any form, and do appear in any form to help others. And there's probably every likelihood that William Shakespeare was a bodhisattva who stripped bare the human personality, the human condition, so well. And that's why we identify with it. You know, we haven't heard Buddha's teachings, but boy, when we read Shakespeare, that is so true. And that can help. Yeah.
If a mind stream is a separate entity, like if I have my own mind stream and you have your own mind stream, what is the force that keeps them separate?
The force?
Like electrons and protons, positive and negative energy?
Well, of course, mind is consciousness, and it's not physical. People ask the Buddha, well, when did it all begin? When did my mind begin? And the Buddha simply said, I see no beginning. And it is clearly expressed in the teachings that the baby's mind is not the result, doesn't come from mother's mind or father's mind. If it did, each child would be born with mother's or father's knowledge and memories and so on, education, but that's not the case. So this is simply the way the Buddha presented it. There are countless individual mind streams, with no beginning. None ever ceases. There's no such thing as a mind stream just stopping. Death, well, rebirth is followed by death, and death is followed by the first link, ignorance, and so on. The circle, the 12 links are a circle. So no mind can stop, nor can any single mind divide into two minds. But highly realized practitioners, one mind stream can manifest in several bodies. Some of our great lamas are different manifestations of the same mind stream. And when we visualize Shakyamuni Buddha, we visualize all these light rays radiating through the pores of his skin, and on each light ray is an emanation. So, when Buddha was turning the wheel of Dharma, for example, in Bodh Gaya 2,500 years ago in India, at the same time, that mind stream was manifesting birth as a Buddha in other places and doing all sorts of things. Does that answer the question? I can't say why two minds don't join, or why one mind can separate, or why one mind can stop. But if you think about it, there is no evidence for that. Yeah.
We can set apart, we can label the Murray River because it's like a steep, even though it changes, it's a single entity. But there's land in between the water. So my question is, what is the land in between the water of our river mindstream?
The land, the banks, you mean?
Separation between, like,
well, I think we cannot experience another person's karma. We cannot transfer our virtue onto another person. It boils down to the basic thing we've been teaching tonight, that karmic impressions are created by our mind, by our actions, and we also have the power to decreate, to extinguish, if we know how. But nobody else can purify our karma for us. Not even holy water.
Isn't it like when you get to a state of realizing emptiness, and there's a, you know, at the level of having removed all the afflictions at the level of a Buddha, then there's actually, while you can trace that where you've been in terms of a mind stream, then the experience is that you're sort of one with other mind streams. Isn't there, you know, that non-duality of experience then is as if every mind stream has been joined. That's my understanding, that there's sort of like one Dharmakaya, but until we actually realize that, we experience life after life as an individual stream. And it is an individual stream until such time as you realize the non-duality and have a different experience.
Right, did people hear that?
But you still remember that the lives you had, the lives you had were yours, you wouldn't think that you were Shakyamuni Buddha.
Yeah, well, this is a debated point, and our holy guru takes one side, and many other gurus take the other side.
What did Rinpoche say?
Rinpoche says there is one Dharmakaya. Mm-hmm. One Dharmakaya is the enlightened mind of Buddhahood. And it's one. Uh, Geshe Lama Lundruk said no, multiple Dhammakayas. It's difficult for us to know what the Dhammakaya, the enlightened mind of Buddhahood, is aware of.
But until we reach that stage, there are bodies that separate.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Look, our bodies, our experiences, are individual.
Our bodies and our consciousness.
Yeah. I mean, there is no indication of that I'm aware of minds joining or separating, dividing. I mean, I'm very interested in this phenomenon of multiple personality, where individuals can manifest like totally different personalities and they sort of take over. I don't know what's going on there. Whether it's memories from past lives or whether you can have two individual mind streams inhabiting a single body. Maybe that's possible. I don't know. I'm interested to find out.
Surely the Dharmakaya, the enlightened mind is omniscient, so that means one Buddha, one mind stream, one Buddha knows everything there is to be known. So another Buddha, one mind stream, knows everything there is to be known. So they know the same thing. They know the same thing. And even this Buddha knows that this Buddha knows.
Yeah, look.
So in that way there is like one Dharmakaya, but it's from different mind streams.
Yeah, I just don't know. I'm prepared to wait for the next next series.
But if that three things are non-dual experience, even when you're, not only in meditation but all your experiences, but you're having a non-dual experience of that.
Of what?
Of reality.
Yeah, but I mean, as far as I know, non-duality refers to the absence of the duality of grasping at inherent existence.
That's one, but there's also the non-duality of subject and object. When you taste honey, there's no, where's the experience of honey is actually.
Yeah, sure, but look, I can't even debate it. All right, so what I've tried to do these 3 weeks is to get across the essential point in Buddhism of what it means to practice Dharma. And at this stage in our lives, there is nothing which can stop us from practicing Dharma. The doctor's diagnosis of cancer, terminal, or whatever, as many seconds as we have left in this human life, we have the opportunity to train our mind, because all our physical aspects, our physical possessions, our physical experiences are like last night's dream at death. It's meaningless. But our mental experiences carry on. And we have the capacity now to train our mind in virtue and to abandon non-virtue. And to not get sucked in by the apparent pleasures of mundane existence. Like we all really believe that the holiday, the possession, the new car, the new clothes, the new partner, the new job, the things are going to make us happy. That's not true. We've been conditioned by our own mind and by society to invest all of our energy into the outside world and find the happiness that is out there waiting for us. We know that's not true, but we can't stop the conditioning. The conditioning is both innate and socially imposed upon us. So even if it's something of, oh, let's go to this restaurant, I like that food, not that restaurant. Why are we choosing the pleasure? Is it from memories? There's no guarantee that the food will be the same. We think it'll be the same. We always go to the same place. It's just meaningless existence, pursuing pleasure. It doesn't mean we should avoid pleasure. Right? If we're unhappy, we can't meditate, we can't study, we can't do much. The mind has got to be happy to really want to do something internally. When things are going wrong, we don't give a damn about Buddhism or our practice, our mantras, whatever. It just seems so irrelevant. No. It's going horribly for me, so we're going to overeat, we're overindulge in alcohol or drugs or cigarettes, or try to distract our mind in entertainments, or we might do something nasty to harm those objects and people who we see as causes of our misery. We've got to realise that what unfolds for us is dependent upon our own side. And so we are actors. Life is a stage. Shakespeare was very right. The world is a stage, and we're all actors upon it. Take that and delight in that. Yes! Now I can write my script. I don't have to be an inherently type of person this way or that way or that way. I can be what I decide to be. And the thing to decide to be is a virtuous person, an ethical person. You know, it's easy to criticize the priests and the cardinals, etc., who have the external appearance of being ethical persons who are not. So instead of wallowing in criticism, dislike and rejection, you be the person who is genuine and sincere in your generosity, in your love, your compassion, your wisdom, and in your ability to admit what you don't know or what you can't do, but not get caught up, too uptight in the mistaken grasping at inherent existent me, inherent existent other. Learn to let things go and take what hand karma deals us, our karma, what we deal ourselves, and work with it. There are so many unknown negative karmas from past lives, ripening always at different times. There are so many positive karmas ripening at different times. Be aware that our lives are the reflection of our past actions, and therefore our present actions will determine the future lives. So it's a long time to act. There's many lifetimes. It's not just one thing now, so don't be disappointed when you blow it and things seem to be getting on top of you. Have confidence that you are going to determine your own future. And you can simply by having a good heart and not being critical of others, but having compassion at the harm caused by others. It doesn't mean we have to be doormats to others' aggressiveness. Of course not. Compassion can be forceful, preventing people from harming others and from harming us. That's not anger. That's compassion. And that's necessary. to deal with situations in life according to what has been set up. So don't be afraid of pleasure. Acknowledge this is ripening virtuous karma. Then, okay, I'll take it. I'll use it. I'll incorporate it into the script of my play, the play of my life. And then, like, life becomes so fascinating, so full of potential. Instead of falling into self-pity, a sense of hopelessness and meaninglessness, life is, it is so wonderful. So many opportunities to not only develop internally, but to help others. Not take pride in it, not be arrogant, but sort of be the, oh, there's an advertisement of the Cadbury's chocolate I saw the other night. Give somebody a secret block of Cadbury's. There's this funny lady who wears a Santa Claus mask, and she gives, did you see it? Blocks of chocolate. Okay, nice thought, but it doesn't have to be. Do something secretly. It's to avoid pride, because pride is a great danger. And so I don't know whether I've succeeded, but I really appreciate you coming tonight, especially it's so hot outside. I hope that you are able to have peace and happiness at Christmas time, remembering the true story of Jesus Christ, who was, undoubtedly a true Bodhisattva, if not a Buddha, demonstrating that morality and self-sacrifice in terms of giving up self-centeredness, me, and giving one's life to others, is the spiritual path. So not only was his example something admirable, but it was a teaching on how we should live our lives. Thank you so much for coming, and thank everybody at Teacher Center and everything that's made this possible, and our lamas. So with the dedication prayers on page 9.